listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. True colors, lights, camera, t-shirt. Promotional merch from film studio A24 has become a must-have wardrobe item for the indie set by Nate Freeman, with opening illustration by Dewey Saunders, showing various t-shirts and actors and actresses in a montage. The website Grailed is the streetwear world's go-to place to find rare, coveted items of clothing being resold by fashion aficionados, often at grand markups from the retail price. A 2017 Louis Vuitton backpack made in collaboration with Supreme will set you back $35,000. An Off-White by Burton by Vogue snowboard, it's just over $18,000 as of press. Chrome Hearts own heart rings activate the platinum card. Lately, right alongside all the covetable totems of drop culture, a burgeoning swath of the resale site has been catering to a strange variant of hype beast lust. Promotional merch for films produced or distributed by A24, the boutique movie studio started by three Hollywood execs in 2012 that engendered the kind of cult appeal once reserved for skate brands and certain punk bands. Many of the shirts with imagery from A24 movies were likely produced for the cost of a decent tee, ink, and maybe some garment dye, but they can sell on Grailed for more than $200. Hoodies can fetch $500. It all came together, and now A24 has a streetwear brand, said Lawrence Schlossman, a former Grailed brand director who now co-hosts the hit menswear podcast Throwing Fits. He mentioned offhand that even with his collection of designer Grails, he owns an A24 shirt and wears it with pride. That A24 has recently had a handful of movies garner lots of buzz, including Mike Mills's Come On, Come On and Sean Baker's Red Rocket, which stars former MTV VJ Simon Rex in a breakout role, might have something to do with the brand's cultural appeal. But there's more to it than that. So since when did movie studios start clout chasing? Just a few years ago, even the idea that anyone would care about the people who put out movies was enough for Robert Pattinson to express disbelief that he was being contacted for a story. It's crazy that there is an article about a distribution company, Pattinson told GQ. That's completely nuts. For the record, A24 expanded into production in 2015. Its principals declined to be interviewed for this story. But as far as indie film companies go, none in recent history has A24's manic track record. After its first theatrical release of the now-forgotten Roman Coppola project starring Charlie Sheen, the company kicked off a years-long hot streak with zeitgeist-capturing films like Spring Breakers and The Bling Ring. Its 2016 film, Moonlight, won the Oscar for Best Picture. A24 also lit up the box office with buzzy, not-dumb horror hits like Hereditary and Midsommar. And it's used said buzz to sell t-shirts that fashion geeks fight over, proving we now live in a world where skate fans and sneakerheads are trading grails made by movie biz suits to promote an art house movie. It used to be that merchandise was simply what a band signed to an independent label like Merge, sold at a folding table by the stage after the show, alongside stickers and CDs. Skate brands made T-shirts so their skaters could rep the logo not just under the deck, but across the chest. The merch wave has, of course, been cresting for some time, arguably since the mid-2010s, when all the off-duty models at Paris Fashion Week rocked T-shirts promoting the skate magazine Thrasher, and Kanye West sold $90 hoodies celebrating a one-off The Life of Pablo listening party at Madison Square Garden, despite estimates that some of his sweatshirts cost barely $20 to make. They can now sell for double on Grailed. The emergence of quotidian apparel as a high-fashion object had a whiff of conceptual art project, a Duchampian attitude in which a urinal could be transubstantiated into museum-worthy sculpture just because the artist said so. Clearly, a studio curating nearly 150 items on a dedicated shop page on its website wants fans of its movies to lust over the A24 dog leashes and A24 beach towels. But what it might not have expected was the idea of an A24 fandom becoming one's entire ethos. Coastal elites who think lit mag tote bags are basic started gramming themselves in A24 snapbacks and sweatshirts with the earnestness of a Knicks fan wearing blue and orange to the Garden. On Twitter, Lonely Hearts joke that they might have to start using A24 to describe their personality on dating apps. Naturally, the celebrities have gotten wind of the mania. In September 2020, Emma Stone was spotted wearing a white hat. Emblazoned with the studio's logo, and in February 2021, Hunter Schafer, star of the A24-produced Euphoria, braved the snow in Manhattan with a burnt orange version. The key to A24's merch supremacy may lie in its collaboration savvy. From the get-go, it has enlisted taste-making streetwear and apparel heads to lend a hand in terms of design and, well, clout. Any graphics-driven streetwear studio would relish the opportunity to collab with A24, Schlossman said. It can platform a collaborator. To some extent, they have the pick of the litter. Elijah Funk, one half of the duo behind hippie streetwear titans Online Ceramics, which has made apparel based on A24 films including St. Maud, The Lighthouse, and Midsummer, explained that he felt the same. When I spoke to him recently, I go on Reddit and there are like A24 kids. It's a full-on lifestyle, Funk said. Their merch drops sell. It's a full-on streetwear drop. The mysterious Queens, New York-based graphic tee as appropriation collective Boot Boys Biz teamed with A24 for an Uncut Gems t-shirt that's now on Grailed for $105. Rare. Sold out in seconds, reads the listing. The horror movie and metal band-inspired merch duo Braindead, started by Kyle Nung and Ed Davis, also lent their imprimatur to a line of A24 products. The major collaboration thus far has been with Online Ceramics. Started in 2016 by Funk and Alex Ross, artists who had previously worked coffee jobs or in the studio of the painter Laura Owens, Online Ceramics makes shirts that are the apparel equivalent of a peace sign embraced in a hug on acid. Designs feature flower power catchphrases and old-school typefaces smashed up against a series of cartoon touchstones, such as flute-toting minstrels, hopping frogs, smiling turtles, butterflies, and many, many Grateful Dead references. They recently also had a show of their paintings and sculpture at David Kordansky Gallery and naturally made merch tees to commemorate the occasion. On sale for $55 at the gallery website, now $150 on Grailed. Their interest in A24 began when the buzz out of Sundance for Hereditary reached Ross, who watched a preview agape. "I watched the trailer and I was like, we have to make merch from this movie," he said. They finished making the design, which featured a scene from the movie wherein a screaming Toni Collette is confronted by her husband on fire on the front with the blurb, "A journey through the deepest and coldest level of hell," in classic OC script on the back, even though they couldn't initially connect with anyone at the movie. "I didn't even know what A24 was at the time," Funk said. "We made the designs and we were going to release it bootleg," Ross said. "We were still pretty small then. We could have gotten away with it," Funk said. Eventually, a friend put them in touch with Zoe Beyer, the A24 creative director and architect of the company's social media voice back in the embryonic days, and the rest is history. They've now branched into hardware, crafting swords for 2021's The Green Knight. They are planning to make more shirts and other things beyond shirts tied to the studio slate this year. But as with indie four pieces minting merch, there is always the question of when the band will sell out. Over the summer, Variety ran a story claiming that A24 had been exploring a sale of the studio, and the price it was floating was between $2.5 billion and $3 billion. Suddenly, A24 was no longer the underdog, but the corporate overlord. And the fun side project of selling stuff on its website didn't seem as quirky. When asked about the potential sale of the rival studio this summer, Tom Quinn, founder of fellow independent production and distribution company Neon, told Deadline his own studio would stay the course, before adding, "I can assure you that what we will not be doing is selling $50 candles." Now onto the red carpet. Stranger in town. Hello, Hollywood. Was I Not What You Were Expecting? By Hannah Gadsby. Opening illustration by Ryan McAmis, which shows Hollywood stars dressed for the red carpet, palm trees in the background, and a photographer snapping photos. What kind of monster would choose white carpet for an outdoor event? The outdoors, no matter how fancy, is just not the natural habitat of carpet, white or otherwise. The issue plagued me so doggedly that I failed to notice I was in the middle of what could have easily been a genuine fever dream. When John Stamos introduced himself to me at the Netflix Emmy party in September 2018 and gushed glowingly about my stand-up comedy special Nanette, I could only watch his mouth move and hope he didn't notice that my mind was elsewhere. The only thing I really wanted to talk about was under our feet. What do you reckon will happen to this carpet tomorrow? Will it have a life beyond this event, Sir Stamos? It was only much later, months in fact, that I was able to process the fact that I had been approached by Uncle Jesse because he knew who I was and wanted to let me know that he liked my work. There is nothing reasonable or logical about that set of facts. And the listener should know that there are some footnotes in this article, the first of which is attributed to Ted Sarandos, relating to the white carpet. Now we continue with the article. When Jodie Foster asked to have her photo taken with me, I failed to be as flattered as I should have been because I was too worried about all the damage the carpet was doing to the turf underneath it. My obsession with the carpet situation was finally broken up when I got a tap on the shoulder by a very small woman. "Are you Hannah Gadsby?" I nodded, praying she would introduce herself, because I had no idea who she was, and she simply nodded back and then announced, "Jennifer Aniston would like to meet you." I expected that the introduction would take place where I stood, but the small woman instead told me to follow her before turning abruptly and disappearing into the crowd. How curious, I thought. This was not an invitation, it was a summons. Intrigued, I trotted after her. After Jennifer Aniston told me how excited she was to meet me, I told her that I was also very excited to meet her. I was being polite, of course. I was not excited. I was terrified. I am autistic. I don't know how to navigate small talk with my best friend. Next footnote, in my defense, my best friend Douglas is a dog. So the prospect of conversing with one of the most enduringly beloved famous people there is was not at all relaxing. What level of admiration does she expect from Riff Raff? Should I inform her that I had not seen friends? I needn't have worried, because apparently Jennifer Aniston just wanted to let me know that she had not seen my show. Touché. It might have been an insult, but somehow Jennifer Aniston managed to make it sound like enthusiastic approval. It was shocking nonetheless, and I forgot myself and replied more bluntly than appropriate. "Why are you telling me this?" My question gave her pause, and as she did, I began to regret my whole existence. "I don't know," she laughed. I laughed, too. It seemed like the polite thing to do. She continued, "It's just that I was on location, and everyone kept telling me that I had to see Nanette, and I didn't have the chance, and when I heard you were here, I just wanted..." She trailed off, almost embarrassed, but I was just relieved that I wasn't the only one who had no idea what the end game was. She grabbed my hands as if to reassure us both. "I will watch it, and I know I will love it," she promised, offering me a clear path out of the awkwardness, which I did not take, But what if you don't? What if you hate it? She patted my hands and replied, I won't tell you. Classic L.A. The show that Jennifer Aniston had not yet seen, Nanette, dropped on Netflix on June 19, 2018. It made such a big splash that within a few months, I'd become the talk of the town, and by that I mean the town. I might have been living the showbiz dream, but, and I can't stress this enough, this so-called dream was never my dream. I just don't see the point of indulging any fantasy that, in practice, could only ever amount to being a monumental waste of time and energy. Because that's what chasing Hollywood success could only ever be for someone like me, given that for most of my life, I have been a financially insecure, autistic, Australian, genderqueer, vagina-wielding situation who does not have a bird-like skeletal system. I might have had a reasonable shot with only one or two of those quirks, but not the whole set, and certainly not with Kate Blanchett already in town, hogging all the moody lesbian roles. I am now financially secure, for the first time in my life. I am also white, which remains a distinct advantage, whether I acknowledge it or not. I am what you could call a festival comic, which means I am something of a long-form comic. I don't build sets by stacking jokes, one on top of the other. I shape shows out of interconnecting material that is designed to pull an audience through a cohesive hour-long experience. To be clear, I don't think this approach to comedy is superior. It is simply different. Furthermore, I should stress that I am not the inventor of this approach, or even the best at it. The Australian and UK festival circuit is full of incredible comedians crafting utterly marvelous hours of comedy year after year, and the quality and depth of the talent pool was such that I never had to pay much attention to what my American peers were saying or how they said it, because I had more than enough brilliance around me to occupy all of my creative curiosity. Well before I even began writing Nanette, I was bored by emotionally reactive comedians who have no problem defending bigotry in the name of laughter. And while it does sound very logical to insist that the singular purpose of comedy is making people laugh, I would argue that we have the internet nowadays, and that really has cornered the market of mindless laughs. It's free, forever, and you don't have to leave the house. And why would you leave the house to go to a comedy club and risk a surprise set from Louis C.K. being all sad and talking about how he wanks like a teenage fascist? Which is to say, with great frequency and absolutely no humanity. If I were pushed to categorize Nanette, I would call her stand-up catharsis, an experiment in the transmutation of trauma. You see, I was not simply telling my audience about my traumas. My goal was to simulate a feeling in the room that was akin to trauma, because I wanted to see if I could create an experience of communal empathy in a room full of strangers. Not just for me, but for all the people who have ever gone to comedy shows and been triggered by all the rape celebrations, violence, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia that gets spewed into microphones the whole world over. The purpose of Nanette was never to catapult me into the top rung of the comedy conversation. Quite the opposite. I was trying to call my audience. I was trying to find my small pocket of genuine fans so I could be who I wanted to be on stage without worrying about making a broad audience feel comfortable. But from the very first time I performed Nanette, my audience refused to let me push them away. They made it clear that they understood my pain and that they cared. For the record, as of yet, Jennifer Aniston has not found me to tell me that she loved Nanette. But I do hold out hope that one day I will get a tap on my shoulder and a small woman will tell me that Jennifer Aniston wanted me to know that she didn't think Nanette lived up to all the hype. That would be amazing. This article was from the book 10 Steps to Nanette, A Memoir Situation by Hannah Gadsby. Copyright 2022 by Hannah Gadsby, to be published by Ballantine Books in the U.S. and Atlantic Books in the U.K. All rights reserved. Fantasy Factory, Child of Dune, my lifetime passion project, managed to survive the upheaval of all Hollywood. Now, let's talk Trilogy by Denis Villeneuve. As Dune neared its release last year, one of my brothers found a part of its origin in a drawer in my parents' home. They were drawings I'd made with my friend Nicholas Kadima, storyboards for a movie we envisioned after reading Frank Herbert's novel. I was probably 13 or 14 years old. We were nerds. Other boys were playing football, but we were writing screenplays. Directors were our gods. Steven Spielberg, Ridley Scott, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese. It's fun to think that when we were boys, we were already dreaming about this. Back then, dreaming was all we could do. I grew up in a small village in Quebec in the early 80s, and we didn't have the resources to actually make movies, even homemade ones. We did some short Super 8 films, but that came later. In Canada, I was told that only crazy people made movies. It was not considered a real job. It was something very far away from us. Maybe too far. I spent decades imagining Dune, several years actually writing and creating it, and another excruciating year when it couldn't be released because of the pandemic. The full journey has taken most of my life. I expected to go into science. I loved biology and mathematics and was a good student. Still, I was fascinated by the art of filmmaking and storytelling. My heart was split in half. My favorite book was one about the human body, which explained things like the science of what happens between the brain and the muscles when you pinch your fingers together. For me, that is sci-fi. I deeply love the science of life, which is probably why Dune resonated with me so deeply. Herbert was a journalist, and his novel was inspired by reporting he did on a coastal community in Oregon where sand dunes were encroaching, driven by intense ocean winds. I grew up by the St. Lawrence River, a very quiet, melancholic place. It wasn't a desert, but the vast horizon dominated there as well. There were two man-made structures that stood out. One was the church, the other a nuclear power plant about 3 miles from our home. I fixated on those two towers, science and religion, both linked by faith. The same ideas are woven throughout Dune. I grew up to have a successful film career in Canada. After the release of my first English-language film, 2013's Prisoners, people began to ask me what my dream project would be. The only thing that came to my mind was Dune. In 2016, while I was working on Blade Runner 2049, I heard that the rights to Herbert's novel were available. When I was doing promotion for Arrival at the Venice Film Festival later that year, I said very loudly and clearly that I wanted to make Dune. Mary Parent, the production head at Legendary Entertainment, was acquiring the rights, and the ink was still drying on the contract when she read about my dreams in the press. We met for 45 seconds, I think. We just looked at each other and said, "Let's do this." Sometimes it takes many years, but then the thing you've hoped for happens all at once. Bringing Dune to life was extremely challenging for everyone involved, but shooting in the desert together created a strong bond between us. It was quite magical, a real adventure. Everybody gave their best. When we were isolated, then we were isolated by the pandemic, finalizing post-production on a movie that would ultimately be delayed for nearly a year. That part was unavoidable. It was about safety for the audience. But soon after, we encountered a disruption that was made by choice. In December 2020, Warner Brothers announced that its entire upcoming film slate would debut simultaneously on its streaming service, HBO Max. I heard the news just before it was announced, and I was so destabilized that I didn't know how to react. Then the anger came. I was asked to stay quiet, but I saw friends like Christopher Nolan speaking publicly, and I felt it was my duty. I spoke out partly for my own sanity, because it's never good to keep anger to yourself. I wrote an open letter and received feedback from all over the world. There's a lot of love out there for cinema and for theaters. At the end of the day, the enemy was the pandemic. Growing up in that remote village, I saw some movies on big screens, but the theaters were far from home. So, as a young kid, I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, for the first time on TV. The same with the first Planet of the Apes, and the original Blade Runner, too. Discovering cinema on TV meant that I was watching movies that were terrible copies, washed out, oversaturated, distorted. When I finally saw the masterpieces in a theater, they had a far greater impact. In the photo, Denis Villeneuve aims to shoot the second movie with Timothée Chalamet as quickly as possible. Dune was a dream designed and shot for the big screen. Streaming is not as bad as a poorly transferred TV broadcast, but it is still a shrinking of something meant to be overwhelming and immersive. There are too many things that you lose launching movies on TV. I understand that for Wall Street, the theaters are a roller coaster, that it's not a stable business, that it's a risky business. And I appreciate streaming because it allows us to revisit films that we loved or to go back in film history. It's fantastic for archives. But movies dreamed and made for the big screen need to be born on the big screen. Cinema is an art form that needs an audience. It's still difficult for me to process that Dune was released on TV at the same time that it debuted in theaters. We still did good numbers theatrically, but what saved us was that the word of mouth was strong and that people were tired of being at home. We are not meant to be isolated. We are meant to be together. Dune arrived at just the right moment. I must add that I've been comforted by the fact that outside the U.S., the movie was shown exclusively in theaters. The success means we get to make the second movie, which means we'll be able to complete the second half of Herbert's novel. That film will debut exclusively in theaters. It's part of the deal. I'm finishing the screenplay now, and we expect to be shooting by summer, which is practically tomorrow morning. With the first half of Dune, the toughest part was introducing the world and laying down the rules. Now, just the fun of the story is left. I'm always very cautious discussing movies that are in the making. They're full of fragile ideas. But the second one will definitely be more visual and less dialogue-driven. And hopefully, there will be another film after that. Dune Messiah, Herbert's second novel in this universe, would make total sense as a third movie because it completes Paul Atreides' arc. I want to make part two as fast as possible. Then I will wait a few years until Timothée Chalamet gets a bit older to do the final installment. I've lived with Dune for most of my life. Being patient is part of the journey. This article was as told to Anthony Bresnikan.
Thank you.
the House of Hollywood for our 28th annual Hollywood issue. Vanity Fair convened 8 shining stars who are breaking boundaries, thrilling audiences, and inventing the movie land they want to live in. A portfolio by Maurizio Cattelan and Pierpaolo Ferrari, styled by Katie Grand. And the opening photo shows all the stars together. Nicole Kidman, Being the Ricardos, 9 Perfect Strangers. And Kristen Stewart, Spencer, shown in the first 2 photos. Nicole Kidman, you might think of her as one of the biggest movie stars in the world, but Nicole Kidman says she loves to approach roles like she is fresh out of theater class. Whoa! Nicole Kidman lets out a nasally wail, her face stretched into exaggerated comic pain, her body covered in bandages, and her weight supported by Javier Bardem. She's acting twice over, playing Lucille Ball as Lucy Ricardo to Bardem's Desi Arnaz as Ricky in Amazon Studios' Being the Ricardos. The dramcom, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, could have been filled with more signature I Love Lucy pratfalls, but Sorkin was more interested in the real-life Ball, a promising dramatic actor who reinvented herself as a comedy star and business executive, hence the multi-dimensional Kidman. When cut is called, it's meta. Kidman snaps out of Ricardo and bolts upright as Ball, rattling off notes to the men. In another scene, Ball sits back in an armchair, her legs outstretched on her desk, as the suits stress about the complications her pregnancy poses for the sitcom. As they struggle to find words to describe Ball's condition, the word pregnant was banned on the air, never mind a baby bump. The comedian makes the men at her feet the punchline. Kidman's pitch-perfect deadpan, somebody should point a goddamn camera at this. Aaron Sorkin wrote her as the smartest person in the room because she was, says Kidman. It was Ball who ultimately convinced CBS to let her Cuban-born husband play her sitcom husband. After divorcing Arnaz, she bought out his shares in Desilu Productions and became the first woman to lead a major production studio. As Kidman says, Ball never apologized for her smarts. A lot of times, particularly as a woman, if you're smart, there's a lot of apology. Kidman has channeled other formidable real-life women, including Virginia Woolf, The Hours, Martha Gellhorn, Hemingway and Gellhorn, Diane Arbus, Burr, Grace Kelly, Grace of Monaco, and Gretchen Carlson, Bombshell. She imbues her fictional characters with such humanity that, on occasion in her prolific Oscar and Emmy-studded career, she's fooled her own immune system into thinking her character's suffering is real, only to fall ill after filming. Parts of the body don't know, a lot of the time, what the difference is between a role and real life, explains Kidman, who got sick after Big Little Lies, in which she played an abuse survivor. I've started to understand a bit more to take care of yourself. Even with a psychologist and scientist for a father, and despite playing analyst types in Batman Forever, The Undoing, and 9 Perfect Strangers, Kidman is allergic to introspection. I try not to overanalyze things, says Kidman, who waves off her breathtaking resume as the result of timing, acknowledging fate, or whatever you want to call it. She doesn't entertain regret, a very dangerous path that can really do your head in. And cynicism isn't sensible. It would deny me the ability to still be completely free and open. She won't even really call herself a movie star. I'm in a state of just being willing to go with the flow. I'm just still in that place of going. I'm not quite sure what defines a movie star. To her, it's all noise. My job is to stay feeling-centric and emotional and committed and interested and a seeker. Kidman has said she considers herself a character actor, and she, like Ball, has embraced her power behind the screen as well. After launching Blossom Films over a decade ago with Parasari, they've produced Rabbit Hole, Big Little Lies, The Undoing, and Nine Perfect Strangers, the actor committed to walking the talk of creating more opportunities with and for women. One forthcoming project, Roar, with a cast that includes Merritt Weaver and Cynthia Erivo, nabbed Apple as an enthusiastic, like-minded partner in that regard. It's very diverse. It's very female-centric, says Kidman. It's also a little oddball, which is great. I'm a little oddball, so I'm happy to support other oddballs. Kidman has enjoyed reaching viewers via the more democratic means of streaming, and she has felt the difference in the public response. Before COVID, people would say, "Can I give you a hug? I want to tell you my story." It was a very different immediate relationship that I hadn't really had. With Portrait of a Lady and Eyes Wide Shut, those things didn't have that response. They were more like pedestal work. This is more grassroots, which has been extraordinary. And yet, after nearly 40 years of acting and more than 80 film and TV projects, Kidman insists, "My whole life is about staying in that place of humility, because you're either in a place of humility or heading towards it." It's a sentiment Kidman shares with her husband, Grammy-winning country musician Keith Urban, and has applied to her own craft. "I still approach acting like I've just come out of drama school," she says. "It's really weird. It's not like I'm choosing to do that. It's just what it is. And when that evaporates, then I have no business being here doing this." This article was by Julie Miller. Now this from Johanna Desta, Kristen Stewart. Her turn in Spencer proves what close observers have always known. Despite her blockbuster past, she has the soul of an indie actor and iconoclast. Kristen Stewart is not going to play it cool. "Everyone wants to win an Oscar, you know," she says. She's looking at me through rose-colored glasses, glowing in the California sun. Her face is sharp and delicate, like a marquise-cut diamond, framed by blonde strands near black at the roots. Her dog, Cole, barks in the Zoom background, lounging somewhere in the spacious Palm Springs Airbnb, where Stewart is on vacation. Stewart is in the midst of an awards campaign for Spencer, Pablo Larraín's haunting portrait of three gasping days in the life of Princess Diana. The role has earned the actor, whose career began at 9 and exploded at 18, a new level of critical acclaim. "I'm totally touched," she says, smiling and taking off her sunglasses. It's actually less about a particular statuette and more about the zeitgeist buoying a piece of work that she's extremely proud of. She's happy to be in the conversation and didn't expect it. Which is to say that after starring in the blockbuster Twilight franchise, she has used her clout to pick surprising films, like Clouds of Sils Maria, an Olivier Assayas drama that earned Stewart a César. For years, Stewart's appeal lay in her coolness, in the mumbling, angsty things she projected in Twilight, and refined over time. There have always been those who argue she's among the best female actors of the millennial generation, and that sentiment is spreading. In the past, she tried to learn lines as close to filming as possible, allowing the words to stay alive longer. The Ram Dass School of Acting, "Be here now or nowhere." But Stewart had to eschew all that to play Diana, which required months of research and accent training. Larraín had unwavering faith in his American star. He was always like, if you wanted it to be, it could be as good as A Woman Under the Influence. And Stewart went inward, channeling Diana's loneliness. One of the remarkable things is that she was so friendless, she says, saddened. I'm constantly going, where was your effing homie? Stewart sank as far as she could into every aspect of the princess's pain, including her battle with bulimia. Spencer depicts her disorder frankly, showing her violently purging in a bathroom. I wanted to make sure that was not glossed over, says Stewart. She prepared herself beforehand, and in the scene, attempted to really purge. I'll do effing anything. Larian, who was operating the camera, pushed in on her anguished face, capturing the act. But Stewart struggled. I couldn't throw up on this movie, even when I really should have, she says. I felt like absolute shit, and I could not get it up. And I know it was because my body was just like, the idea of that was so untouchable. Despite her obsessive research, Stewart didn't become an expert on the contemporary royals, and only watched snippets of the explosive Prince Harry and Meghan Markle interview with Oprah Winfrey. It was almost too hot to touch in terms of how personal it was for me at that time, she says. I ask her if it's strange to think about Harry and Meghan living in California. As improbable as it seems, Stewart was unaware of their move. That's so funny. I wonder where, she muses. Then she stops. I'm no better than anyone. Of course I want to know. Santa Barbara, I tell her. She nods approvingly. That makes sense. It's really nice up there. Stewart herself lives in L.A., and in November revealed her engagement to her girlfriend of more than 2 years, screenwriter Dylan Meyer. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.